the causality principle in the world of being, because I will, unfortunately, I'll have to leave early tomorrow morning. I will not be able to participate in the final panel discussion, but of course I will be at the discussion this afternoon. There are, of course, many things that I haven't talked about, but since I have given you this booklet, which you can read at your leisure, you can see that I do treat more detailed laws like hukukula and zakat and the inheritance laws and so on within the framework of this fundamental notion of causality. So I won't take our time together to go into these detailed laws. So I intend to leave more time than previously for discussion, but I do have a few things that I want to say to lay the groundwork for our last exchange. Yesterday we saw that according to the Kitab-i Aqdas, the fundamental relationship that we humans have is between us and God. To recall again the statement of Shoghi Effendi to that effect, he says, this is on page 213, the core of religious faith is that mystic feeling which unites man with God. And then on page 214, the Baha'i faith, like all other divine religions, is thus fundamentally mystic in character. Now, what does he mean by fundamentally mystic? Well, he means what he just said, that the core of religious faith is that mystic feeling which unites man with God. In other words, religion is the relationship between God, the highest thing in existence, and the human being, the highest thing in creation, and the connection. I said it is a relationship. So, oh, I see. Oh, that's okay. No problem. Whenever you have a relationship, you have three things involved. You have the two things that are related, and you have the link or relationship between them. So a relationship involves three things, not two things. And so religion is the relationship between God and man. So you have God, you have man, and you have the connection between them. And the connection is the manifestation. That is exactly the ringstone symbol, right? That's exactly what the ringstone symbol has. The world of God, the world of man, and the connection between them, which is the manifestation. And this connection is both horizontal and vertical. That is, it is horizontal. Okay. We know that the symbol for the manifestation is the same as the symbol for the Holy Spirit in the ringstone symbol. So I will make not even a false attempt to do Arabic calligraphy. But if you notice the ringstone symbol, that the symbol for the manifestation is the same as the symbol for the Holy Spirit. Well, it cuts through like that, right? It's the same as the symbol for the Holy Spirit. So you have God, you have man, and then you have the connection between God and man, which is the manifestation, the manifestation is both an intermediate level of being between God and man, and it is at the same time the vertical connection between God and man. So this ringstone symbol sums up the essential metaphysical relationships that are the foundation of reality. Now, I've spoken quite a bit about the law of causality. And we tend to think of the law of causality as an impersonal thing. Because the example that one most often uses, and it's not just me, it's the example that's most frequent in hand, is gravity. And gravity operates independently of our will. And therefore, when we are thinking about causality, we tend to think, or a causal law, we tend to think of it as being something that is impersonal, right? Whereas what Baha'u'llah is saying when he gives us the law of prayer is that our wills are a causal agent. In other words, to say that we have a free will is to say that our will is an entity, an objectively existing entity, which is a causal agent. So, in other words, our will, the exercise we make of our will, determines the way reality functions. In other words, again, to take the simple example I took yesterday, I pick up this glass, I put it here. Why is this glass here instead of here? Because I have a free will, okay? If I didn't have a free will, that glass would still be there right now, okay? Because it's only the exercise of my free will that has put that glass there. So the exercise of our will is one of the determinants of reality. So our will, your will, what the use you make of your God-given capacities is part of the law of causality. Now, this is both a wonderful and a frightening thing. It is wonderful because it means that God allows us to participate in creation, if you will, in reality. It is also frightening because it means that we have an incredible responsibility in the way that we use our faculties and our will. Now, so this relationship between God and man is the fundamental relationship that we humans have. It is the foundation of all other relationships. If this relationship is wrong, nothing else will be right. And if this relationship is right, everything will eventually be right. Maybe not tomorrow, but everything flows from this relationship. Now, just as we've seen that there are hierarchies in reality, there are hierarchies in the physical world, there are hierarchies in the spiritual world. There's a hierarchy in the human world. There's a hierarchy of human relationships. And the second most important human relationship is the relationship between husband and wife. And this, as Dr. Danish points out, and as I point out in this booklet, if you take the order in the Kitab-i Aqdas, and I agree completely with Hussein that there is an extremely fine logical order in the Kitab-i Aqdas. Far from being haphazard and far from being just a unique literary style, which it already is. I mean, that's fine. But there is, from the purely logical point of view, Hussein talked from the psychological point of view, but from the purely logical point of view, there is a fine and exact order in every word and letter in the Kitab-i-Akbar. Essentially, let me just say what the order is that Baha'u'llah sees the family as the prototype for the whole of the human reality. In other words, the Kitab-i-Aqdas recreates human society in the image of the healthy family. So when we speak, as we sometimes do, of the family of nations, or the family of man, or the human family, this is, according to the Kitab-i-Aqdas, the most appropriate metaphor for the collectivity of human beings. Baha'u'llah views human society as an extension of the family. Now, let's try to look at this with the eye of Baha'u'llah. We've talked about this, Vahid has talked about this, Hussein has talked about this, about looking at the Kitab-i-Aqdas according to the through the eyes of God and not through our own eyes. So I'm going to say a few things about marriage, but let me be very frank in the beginning. Look, marriage is going through a very rough time in our society, right? And we all suffer from this. We all suffer from this. So I have no doubt that every person in this room is either unmarried or divorced or married with various degrees of satisfaction, okay? And there's no one in this modern world who has not experienced terrible tests in relationship to his marriage. I mean, I have been fortunate to be happily married for 35 years to a wonderful woman, but we have had our tests. And we have had to struggle extremely hard at times in our marriage. And so this is the reality. We know this is the reality. And so let's, for a few moments, let's suspend the reaction that we have of seeing what Baha'u'llah says about marriage from the point of view of our own limited and perhaps unhappy or painful experience. And let's try to see the image that Baha'u'llah has. Now, as we know, the goal of the Baha'i faith is unity. Unity in diversity. So, this notion of unity and diversity is a much more subtle notion than we Baha'is give it credit, okay? I mean, this phrase, unity and diversity, rolls off of our tongues just like water, but we do not realize how profound this concept is. It means, of course, as we teach people, that the unity in the Baha'i faith is not a uniformity. The uniformity is not making everybody the same. It is not a hyper-egalitarian form of unity. It is a unity which has differences, appropriate differences. Well, nowhere is this more clear than in the relationship between the sexes, between husband and wife. I mean, here you have in marriage a unity. You have a unity. But obviously you have difference, and you have the most fundamental difference that exists in created reality, the difference between the sexes, between man and woman. So marriage itself is a unity and diversity. In other words, you have, the word in Russian is very good here for sex is polarnost, polarity. And this is really what sexual difference is. It's a polarity. Let me say a word about polarity. Maybe I shouldn't get into this. I don't know. Polarity You see, well, the whole discourse about the faith is shot through with profound philosophical confusions, in which we unconsciously transfer the principles that are true of one area to another area in which they do not apply. I've given you one example of that when I talked about the difference between applying materialistic reasoning to spiritual things the other day. When, remember, I said that a material thing is diminished when it's shared, but a spiritual thing is multiplied when it's shared. Well, one of the confusions that is endemic in our discourse is the confusion between duality and polarity. These are not the same thing. Duality refers to an essential difference. So good and evil are dual. You can't have good and evil together. If it is good, it is by definition not evil. So it's like light and darkness. You can't have light and darkness at the same time. If you have light, you don't have dark. If you have dark, which is the absence of light, you don't have light. I mean, just take the definition of dark. Darkness is the absence of light. So you can't have light and the absence of light at the same time. That's a formal logical contradiction. I cannot have a thing and not that thing at the same time. So duality is opposition. It is exclusion. Duality is a mutual exclusion. Good and evil, light and dark, heat and cold, these are dualities. Polarity, well, and of course, ultimately we know that on the highest level, there is no duality because God is one. This is one of the meanings, the philosophical or metaphysical meaning of the oneness of God. That, I mean, because this is a fundamental question of philosophy. It's called the question of the one and the many. And it preoccupied the best minds of ancient Greece, and it continues to be a controversy today. Monism versus pluralism. And so the first question is the ultimate reality? I mean, we have both oneness and plurality on the level of creation. That's obvious. Everybody knows that. The question of the one and the many is whether the ultimate reality is one or dual. And of course, the Baha'i Faith gives us the answer to this. The ultimate reality, which is God, is absolutely one. There is no duality on the highest level of existence. There is, as Abdu'l-Bahá says, no differentiation within the essence of God. However, on lower levels of reality, we do have duality because, well, I'm sorry, let me back up. The fact that the ultimate reality is one means that there is only one source of energy in the universe. In other words, there are not two sources of energy. So this is the Baha'i notion of the non-existence of evil. There are not, so the notion of a devil or a Satan is a dualistic notion. In other words, the fact that you have a god and an anti-god of some sort, okay, as a positively existing force, like a devil, this is a dualistic notion of ultimate reality. So when Abdu'l-Bahá says that evil does not exist as an objective force, this is simply a rearticulation of the notion of the oneness of God. There cannot be a single source of reality, namely God, who is all good, and at the same time that there be evil, metaphysical evil. These are logically incompatible. So there is only one energy. It all comes from God. However, on the lower levels of existence, this energy can be either manifest or not manifest in a certain situation. So to take, again, the simple analogy, physical analogy to understand this, is the sun. If we were to go to the sun, Of course, it would physically destroy us if we did, but I mean, just in imagination, if we were to go to the sun, there is only light in the sun. In other words, you would find no shadow in the sun, right? There's no duality in the sun itself. But the sun generates its rays, and when these rays are incident on a lower reality, which is the earth, then it creates patterns of darkness and lightness, of shadow. And the shadow is the absence of the light. So duality is a relative notion. But duality means opposites then. Duality means this opposition that is created by the relative incidence of primal energy in the lower levels of existence. Okay? So that's duality. Duality is opposition. It is mutual exclusion. Polarity means the manifestation of the same energy in complementary forms. So plus and minus in electricity, for example, is an example of polarity, not duality. All right? In other words, positive charge or negative charge is the same energy, but manifested in two different forms. Okay? That's polarity, not duality. Now, the most potent example of polarity, not duality, but polarity, in existence is sexual polarity in the human being, because we know that the human being is the highest form of existence, is the highest created thing. We've gone over this again and again and again. And therefore, the polarity that exists in the human race is the highest, most refined, ultimate expression of polarity in creation. Again, there is no polarity in God. And of course, this destroys completely all of this sort of pseudo-feminist stuff about whether God is masculine or feminine and so on. On the level of the essence of God, there is no differentiation. Therefore, there is no manifestation of polarity whatsoever in the essence of God. Polarity, sexual polarity, is the manifestation of the same energy, but in complementary forms. Now, what does this mean in complementary form? This means, well, as we've already said, every individuation, particularization means what? Particularization means that an individual has certain dominant attributes, in other words, certain strong points and certain weak points. Okay? Just as we've said, every individual person and every individual culture has certain strong points and certain weak points, certain natural strong points, certain natural weak points. So that is individuation. Universality, which is the manifestation of God, is to have all the attributes to the maximum degree. So the manifestation is universal. He is not particular. He is universal. Remember, the other night we talked about this hierarchy of universal to particular. So the characteristic of particularity is that particularity selects some attributes to a greater degree than others. Okay? Now, what sexual polarity does is it creates a complementary selection of attributes. And what does this complementarity mean? It means that the strong points of one are the weak points of the other. In other words, each one has what the other lacks. In other words, the strongest point of the masculine pole correspond exactly to the weak points of the feminine pole, and the strong points of the feminine pole correspond to the weak points of the masculine pole. So each has what the other lacks. Now, if we have a duality, what happens when there is a confrontation between dualities? When there's a confrontation between dualities, there is a sharp border. There is an absolute frontier that is created. So in other words, there is no ambiguity between light and dark. Okay? In other words, if you shine a bright light, the point at which the light stops and the dark begins is a clear frontier. And the stronger the light, the clearer the frontier. I mean, of course, you can have a fuzzy line if you have gradations. You have less and less and less light. But if you have the confrontation of light with absolute absence of light, then you have an absolutely sharply defined frontier, right? But what happens when you have the confrontation between polar opposites? What you have is creativity. What you have is creativity. In other words, the joining or the confrontation or the linking of opposite polarities creates unity. It creates love. Now, so this is the unity and diversity. Now, what is unity? Unity is justice plus love. So that's a simple, straightforward definition of unity. Notice that the unity of the material world is a result of two things. The justice, which is the laws governing it, and the love, which are these four fundamental forces I talked about the other day, that is, the dynamic forces of attraction between these entities. So you cannot have unity without both justice and love. If you have justice without love, what you have is a framework for unity. You have a formal juxtaposition, but you have no dynamism. It is dead. And this is what we call in religion legalism and formalism, a body without life. Love without justice is dynamism. It is the force of attraction, but if it is not regulated or channeled by justice, then, of course, even though the force of love itself is positive, it can be dissipated or misused if it is not regulated by justice. So unity is the result of the marriage, if you will, the creative marriage between the polarities of love and justice. Of course, again, ultimately, on the level of the essence of God, these are the same thing. There is no difference between the mercy of God and the justice of God. The justice of God is the mercy of God. The mercy of God is the justice of God. Ultimately, but we experience these as differentiated realities, in fact, as polarities in a certain sense, because just think again of the law of gravity. Think of the earth going around the sun. The force of gravity, which is like love, okay, attracts these two together. This is the force of love. But the law of gravity, that is, what regulates the force, which says that this force takes place within certain limits, which is the inverse square law of Newton, means that the centrifugal force of the earth going around the sun holds the earth in an orbit. In other words, it is the balance or justice, adjustment between these two forces, the centrifugal force of the earth going around the sun, balancing the gravitational force that makes the expression of this force, of this love, this attraction, to be ordered and productive. Yes, or dissipated. Yes, or dissipated. Unwisely used. Love is always positive in itself, but love can be inappropriately expressed or used. Well, a perfect example, if two people truly love each other and are not married and have sexual relationships, then that's unjust according to the Katabiagda. So that is an unjust expression of love. That doesn't mean that the love is not a true love. This is a very subtle point, okay? People, when this happens, as it sometimes happens, that people fall in love with each other and love each other very much, and they say, well, we really love each other. We know that we love each other. So there are momentary reasons that we can't get married, but there's no reason why we shouldn't express our love physically because we know this is a true love. And they are led maybe to violate the law of God on this point. And then afterwards, when there are consequences to this, then people go through the contortions of saying, well, it wasn't really true love. It wasn't really love. It was just infatuation. It was just fascination. Well, maybe it was true love. I mean, we don't have to go through those contortions. You know, we know in the first place that all human love has a degree of self-interest, so there's no doubt that ego is involved in the thing. But we don't have to destroy this. We don't have to say that this was not a true love. All love comes from God. There is no love that doesn't come from God. But God not only gives us the love, he gives us the love manual that tells us how to use the love that he gives us. And that's justice. So what happens if one is led to express love in a way that is contrary to justice? It destroys the love. That's what happens. So can love exist in the absence of justice? Yes. Can love endure in the absence of justice? No. If injustice persists, love will be destroyed. Let me give a very practical example of this. A couple meet. They fall in love. They get married. Now, you know how it is when you're in love with somebody. The only thought you have is to please the other person, right? I mean, this, when you love, this is the only thought you have, is how can I make this person happy? Now, a cynic would say, well, this is simply a disguised form of egotism. All you want is the approval of this other person, and so on and so on. But I don't believe that's true. Love is the recognition of the value of the other. So when we recognize this value, we want to enhance that value. You know, if I love a woman, I want to say, how beautiful she is. I want others to see how beautiful she is. I feel proud when we go out and other people look and say, what a beautiful wife you have, or what a, you know, and so on and so on. When we recognize the value, we want to enhance the value. That is the natural expression of love. So people fall in love. They get married. Each seeks to please the other. That's your greatest desire, is to please the beloved. Well, as things go on in the relationship, there are challenges. And it may happen, for example, I just take one possible example. Love is a transaction. Love is expressed as a series of transactions of giving and receiving. Now, this relationship may evolve to the point where one partner is doing all the giving and the other is doing all the receiving. Now, what will happen at this point? Well, the person who's doing all the giving will begin to feel certain resentment. The person will begin to say, you know, I'm doing all this stuff, I'm making all these meals, I'm doing all these things, and showing all this affection, and I don't get very much expression in return, you know? This seems to be taken for granted. But of course, I shouldn't feel this because I love this person. So you sit on this for a while. You suppress this, you know. You say, I shouldn't be feeling this. You begin to feel guilty that you feel this. But the feeling persists. The feeling persists. And finally, it can't be contained. And so the partner is confronted with this. Look. You know, this relationship is unsatisfactory because, in effect, I'm doing all the giving and you're doing all the receiving. And so, typically, the other partner will say, well, I thought it was a perfectly fine relationship. I thought everything was great. Of course everything was great. For that partner, everything was great. So, at this point, the original love has gradually been replaced by feelings of resentment, by negative feelings, by lack of love. What has destroyed the love? The injustice in the relationship. This lack of symmetry in the relationship has destroyed the love. Now, how can we restore the love to the relationship? There's only one way. You can pray till you're blue in the face. You can make professions of love till you're blue in the face. There is only one way to restore love to that relationship, and that is by reestablishing or establishing justice. In other words, the couple has to confront the asymmetry that is in the relationship. They have to recognize it. They have to deal with it. And they have to change their attitudes and their behavior in such wise that justice is established. And when justice is reestablished, then love will flow from it. Because, as I said the other day, the definition, one definition of justice is simply to say that justice is the conditions under which love flourishes. That's all justice is. You know, I mean, we can talk about justice in terms of laws and rules, and that's correct as far as it goes. Justice does express itself as rules. In other words, of statements of limitations. But on the deeper spiritual level, justice is simply the conditions under which love flourishes. Yes. Well, that's one expression of justice. It is not the only expression of justice, but it is one very fundamental expression of justice. Surely, the golden rule is one of the central expressions of justice. Right. Of reciprocity, of symmetry. That's right. Sure. Absolutely. Okay. Now, as I say, when these polarities of male and female come together, this is a complementary difference. And so there is creativity. There is the greatest creativity that exists that is possible in human relationships. And of course, the physical metaphor for that creativity is the fact that another human being is actually created by that union. What could be a more powerful symbol of the creativity of the meeting of the sexes than that creativity produces another human being? Could there be a more powerful creativity than that? Obviously, there cannot. So, sexual polarity is complementary, creative, dynamic. It is capable of producing the greatest unity that can exist between human beings. As Abdu'l-Bahá says in Star of the West, no mind can conceive of the unity that God has destined for man and wife. No man can conceive of the unity and harmony. This is quoted in the booklet, in paraphrase. No man can conceive of the unity and harmony that is destined for husband and wife. So this is the potential of the marriage relationship. Well, look, one fundamental rule of existence is the following. Whatever has a great potential for good has an equally great potential for evil when it is misused. In other words, if something has very little potential for good, that means it has very little energy, it has very little power. So it has very little potential for being misused either. But the greater the potential for good, when properly used, the greater the potential for evil when misused. So, what is the greatest good that there is? Well, Baha'u'llah tells us, the greatest gift of God to man is revelation, is the manifestation. He says first, the greatest gift of God to man that is inherent in man is the gift of understanding. And he says the gifts of the heart and the sight and the hearing and the like are also among the gifts which God has given man. Then he says all of these gifts are inherent in man himself, but that gift which is greater than all of these and is supreme over all other gifts is the gift of revelation. So religion, true religion, this connection between God and man, which is true religion, the manifestation, if you will, is the greatest of all gifts that God has given man. Well, if we follow this principle then, which is really the duality principle, if you negate the greatest good, you get the greatest evil. Okay? That's the duality principle. The greatest evil is obtained by negating the greatest good. Okay? Evil is the negation of good. Okay? That's duality, not polarity. And the greater the good, the greater the evil. I mean, okay? So what does Baha'u'llah tell us is the greatest evil? What does he tell us? It's explicit in the writing. What? What? No. What does he say is the greatest of all evils? What? Religious fanaticism. The greatest of all evils, he says, is religious fanaticism. Religious fanaticism is the flame which will devour everything. Religious fanaticism is the misuse of religion. It is the negation of the greatest gift, which is revelation. That's why, if we look in the history of mankind, the greatest contributions to the progress of mankind have been inspired by religion. Okay? All the sciences and the arts and the good works, as Baha'u'llah says in that one passage, you know, for 2,000 years after the sacrifice of Jesus, all of the arts, the power exercised by the greatest monarchs, and so on and so on. In other words, all of the truth, the beauty, and the goodness all of the legitimate expressions of knowledge, love, and will were due to the influence of the manifestation of Jesus in this case, when he's speaking about. And if you look into history, as any agnostic or atheist will tell you, the greatest cruelties and evils in history have been done in the name of religion. Well, the psychologic of it is simple. Why does one do evil? One does evil because one wants to obtain something. I mean, you do evil from some motivation. I mean, you can do evil out of ignorance, of course, but that's not deliberate evil, okay? So conscious evil, the perpetration of conscious cruelty, is in order to get something. As we say in modern psych, what is the payoff, right? We have to find out what is the payoff. So, I mean, a thief steals because he wants those material things. And a person murders another person because that other person is somehow interfering with that person's desire to get something he wants, maybe fame or the other guy's wife or whatever. Okay? So we perpetrate acts of evil for a reason.